You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of April 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Robert Bound. On today's show, President Obama planned to pivot to Asia, but somehow he forgot to do it.
He's twice or three times canceled now trips to Asia at some point or other, once for healthcare, once for the shutdown. I think this shows how hard it is to pivot when the rest of the world isn't cooperating.
We'll discuss with Jeffrey Kaufman and Kathleen Burke whether he'll be able to build bridges on his four-country tour of the continent. Then we'll ask whether a genocide is taking place in the world's newest democracy and hear if political campaign ads can ever go too far. Plus, we'll check in with our man in Buenos Aires and hear why comic book heroes usually guarantee success at the box office.
It tied in a moral story. It tied in American malaise, how we used to think about America, what America's like now, how the world is, but it also had a lot of fun. If you didn't want to be political, there's a lot of fun in there too.
All that plus a review of the week in music. That is Midori House with me, Robert Bounds, right now. Plenty to keep us talking on the next hour here on Michael 24, but now at the top of the hour, it's news time with Jonathan Wheatley.
The United Nations says hundreds of civilians have been killed in an ethnic massacre in South Sudan, which happened earlier this month. UN human rights investigators have confirmed that opposition forces killed hundreds of South Sudanese and foreign civilians after determining their ethnicity or nationality, when they captured Bentiu last week. The mission called for these atrocities to be fully investigated and for the perpetrators and their commanders to be held accountable. The UN spokesman is Stefan Dujarric.
Between April 15th and 17th, the mission extracted hundreds of civilians who were facing threats of violence in several places in Bentiu and Rubkona, where they had taken refuge. Over 500 civilians, including many wounded, were extracted from the Bentiu hospital and other places, while thousands were escorted as they walked to the UNMISS base.
The husband of an American tourist in critical condition after being wounded by homemade improvised fireworks on the island of Santorini in Greece has asked that people pray for his wife. Chris Presmike is one of three American tourists and a Greek injured on the 29th of April from makeshift fireworks thrown as part of a tradition after Easter midnight mass on the Santorini island. The US Vice President Joe Biden has visited the famous Mikhailovsky Monastery in Kiev after holding meetings with Ukrainian leaders on Tuesday. He called on Moscow to remove troops built up on the borders of Ukraine and to, as he put it, stop talking and start acting on the surrender of pro-Russian separatist militants in the east of the country.
This is a second opportunity to make good on the original promise made by the Orange Revolution. This is a genuine opportunity to get right what is always difficult to do the first time when coming out from under the oppression or control of another power.
Here, David Cameron's former media chief Andy Coulson has told a London court he had not listened to hacked voicemail messages that exposed an affair between the actress Sienna Miller and James Bond star Daniel Craig. Coulson, who was the Prime Minister's head of communications until 2011, is charged with conspiracy to hack phones of high-profile celebrities and politicians whilst he was editor of Rupert Murdoch's now-defunct News of the World tabloid. During US President Barack Obama's four-nation tour of Asia that is meant to begin tomorrow, Wednesday, analysts are saying that his toughest challenge will be to reassure sceptical leaders that the US intends to be more than just a casual observer and instead is genuinely committed to countering an increasingly assertive China in the region. Well, Dr. Jonathan Pollack, foreign policy analyst at the US Brookings Institute, says Obama must be candid.
Assuring different states of the credibility of U.S. policy, the determination, despite events in the Middle East and despite events in Central Europe, that the United States means what it says in terms of a redirection to Asia and the Pacific. But at the same time, he's got to very candidly talk to allies about very specific issues where either the U.S. is not in full agreement with allies, or where allies are having big differences between themselves.
And finally, the FBI has said that a teenage boy who ran away from home has survived a five-hour flight in the freezing well on top of a wheel of a jetliner that reached 38,000 feet as it travelled from Hawaii, from California to Hawaii. The 16-year-old from Santa Clara in California quickly lost consciousness as temperatures in the compartment sank as low as minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan Wheatley. It's 18.05 here in London. You're tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a sec.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You are tuned in to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06, lunchtime in New York City. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio is Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent with ABC News America, and Kathy Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London. Welcome both to the show. I thought I'd leave a little pause there.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And our top
all
story
is well in the world.
As top story today, I'm glad that you've done your round the table dance and you've decided where you're going to sit. Thought there was going to be a political incident in the studio. Our top story today is the visit by US President Barack Obama to Asia. That's happening tomorrow. Before we discuss what happened to Obama's pivot to the Far East, Monocle's Phil Hahn has this report.
It's been a long time coming. President Barack Obama arrives in Japan tomorrow, the start of a four-nation tour of Asia. The president is hoping to reaffirm his commitment to the region, his so-called pivot to Asia, which he lauded back in late 2011.
The United States is and always will be a Pacific nation. As the fastest growing region in the world, the Asia-Pacific will shape so much of our security and prosperity in the century ahead, and it is critical to creating jobs and opportunity for the American people.
Despite, however, being a foreign policy centerpiece of his second term, the president has largely remained absent.
He's twice or three times canceled now trips to Asia, at some point or other, once for health care, once for, I think, the budget
shutdown,
fight,
yeah.
Last fall for the shutdown. So yeah, I think this shows how hard it is to pivot when the rest of the world isn't cooperating.
Instead, much of the administration's attention has been focused on crises in Ukraine, Iran, Syria, and the Middle East. On this trip, the president, who will visit Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines over the next week, is hoping to ease those concerns.
Assuring different states of the credibility of U.S. policy, the determination, despite events in the Middle East and despite events in Central Europe, that the United States means what it says in terms of a redirection to Asia and the Pacific.
It's expected the president will announce closer military cooperation, but also more trade announcements. The visit is also being seen as an opportunity to build closer ties in the face of a more powerful China.
With the re-rise of China on the world stage is going to be probably the most important event we face in the first half of this century.
Former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage. But President Obama may have a tough time building those bridges. A slew of regional disputes from South Korea to Japan and a more nationalist Shinzo Abe are making the hurdles all the more difficult. For Monocle, I'm Phil Hahn.
And that was Phil Hahn's report on Obama's upcoming visit to Asia.
Was he playing the violin while he was doing that? I just want to know, was the violin him as he was talking?
Yeah, that's what he does.
He is a talented man.
He's one of those people that has his own soundtrack that follows him around.
Remarkable commentary.
What do we think President Obama's soundtrack might be following him around Asia? Do you think it would be as mellifluous as a string quartet, or do you think it might be a little bit more discordant?
I think one of the things we've learned from Obama is, and I guess we learned it from every politician, is that you know they'll say the right thing. Things, but reality is just tied Obama's hands. I mean, he has just, as Phil noted, quite correctly, been distracted by more pressing issues. And as much as he wants to keep pivoting to Asia, you know, this week it's Ukraine, you know, a few months ago it was Syria, he has just not been able to wrestle the agenda enough to make any significant overtures. And so finally, having canceled this, as noted, for healthcare first and then last fall for the budget shutdown, he's actually going to make it, which is an accomplishment. But I think there's a fair amount of skepticism along the way.
Kathy, how fares that assessment of Obama's upcoming visit? He jets off tomorrow, and it's a sort of full country tour. We were talking in sort of musical language. What do you think it might sound like?
Oh, a dirge, perhaps.
It doesn't sound good, does it? And why is this? Is this because Obama's constantly being forced to react to things? This seems like a piece of foreign policy which is all about being proactive. I guess this is something that's long been on his agenda, this pivot.
Well, it's reactive in the sense it's reactive to the rise of China. The U.S. had sewn up the Far East for a generation, mm-hmm. two generations. And now all of a sudden, well, if you call the last 5 years all of a sudden, it now has to react and to think again. It also, of course, has a Japan that's getting restive. Obama could probably help one or the other, but having them both at the same time is a bit of a challenge. Fortunately, South Korea is quite cuddly, so they don't have to worry about them.
But then there's a problem of South Korea and Japan not talking. There's sort of problems that have been sort of 70 years in the making, which are being sort of, these hot coals are being walked over once again.
Well, what's interesting?
How much should he be the statesman that sort of unites them all together, and how much should he try?
Well, what's interesting to me is the fact that how much importance history is. It's not just bases. It's not just airlines. It's also comfort women, and it's Shanghai, and it's all the historical incidents, particularly between Japan and China from the Second World War, that continues to rub badly, which means that public opinion is going to be very difficult to get a public opinion in any of these countries behind any firm actions their leaders want to take.
Jeffrey Kaufman's on from stroking his chin to
exhaling. I think that really what Obama is, you know, this pivot to Asia is a code for counterbalancing China's power, as was noted. And I think that the challenge here is to, one, reassure the other Asian nations that the U.S. is there and behind them with the Seventh Fleet, and two, not to so overtly antagonize China that it's seen to be provocative. I mean, the U.S. has enough problems with Russia right now. They don't need to up the tension with China. But clearly, the rise of China is what he's looking at counterbalancing, and there's no easy solution. China is becoming a great military power, and somehow the U.S., without spending a lot more money, without expending a lot more political energy, has to show that it really cares. I mean, I think Obama may be regretting his statement that the U.S. is fundamentally a Pacific nation. I mean, I think it was a stretch, first of all, historically, to say that. I mean, it's a nation of two oceans at the very least, if not more. Yeah. I think he overpromised, and now he's you know, trying to even underdeliver. He's trying to deliver something.
Kathy, you raised your fingers. You wanted to make a point. It was around the time Jeffrey was mentioning the Seventh Fleet and being protected by it, possibly.
Well, the problem with all of these sorts of statements, the Seventh Fleet, NATO airplanes on the Polish border and so forth, is a question of credibility. That is to say, the real doubt internationally now is, will the U.S. use it? It makes no, never mind having the largest nuclear sub fleet if no one believes anything's going to happen. Diplomacy needs at least the menace, the threat of a menace of military power behind it. And that's what no one believes the United States has.
I think that's right. I think that comes out of Syria. I think that Syria simply, the red line in Syria over chemical weapons really, really damaged Obama's credibility. And I think it's true that in Asia, they've noted that as well.
And this is the Syria, and this presumably also the Ukraine. The idea that there isn't any, there isn't maybe a lot of will behind some. There's statements more than there's maybe will behind those statements to intervene in these places. What's China thinking? It's just watching calmly from the sidelines. How subtle can Obama be about this mission to contain China? I mean, I wonder what you feel his rhetoric will be and what it has been on buddying up to China but containing China.
Well, I suppose, first of all, he'll say that traditionally the United States and China have been close powers, referring back to the 19th century, for example, referring to Sun Yat-sen, if he must, although I don't think the People's Republic would be quite so keen on that one, referring to the Second World War. The problem is that you can only have, there's a limit to the number of lovers one can have, okay? If China's your lover... We'll talk about this later.
This is none more analogous speak.
Let's get Phil back with that music, please.
Yeah, exactly.
the only point I want to make is that Obama is going to have difficulty treating each of these countries as a U.S. good close friend. And that means in the question of balance, the possibilities of walking, well, you know, talking loudly and having no stick is just imminent in the Far East.
And let's be clear, he's not going to China. I mean, it's very clear that he's, you can see where the emphasis is.
This is a sort of the elephant in the room. Everyone's expecting this to signal his intentions on China, but without going there. This is a strange thing. Maybe this is the sort of thing that Michelle Obama was dispatched to China, but her husband is not really addressing the elephant in the room, perhaps.
Well, he's already met with the Dalai Lama. He's already traded with Taiwan. Mm. He's antagonized China in those little ways that really annoy China. So he's made his decisions in that area. I think this is not really so much as obviously he wants China to hear, but I think it's about the other nations coming on board. And there's a huge trade agenda here too. I mean, let's be clear that a big part of it is that the U.S. does trade heavily in this region and wants to build and support trade.
But can we just also remember that this is not only one way? That is to say, how can China ferociously threaten the United States? We're talking as though the question is, here's this great China, and will the U.S. tiptoe around or will it bring out missiles? I think this is an unbalanced approach to the Far East crisis, in fact.
We're going to change topic now, Jeffrey and Kathy. We're going to talk about South Sudan and this massacre that the UN reported last week, including some rebels apparently using FM radio to broadcast ethnic-based hate speech and encouraged, quote, men from one community to commit vengeful sexual violence against women from another community. How has this got to this?
It's just horrific to read it. It feels like Rwanda all over again, doesn't it? I mean, this is a country that has been independent for not even 3 years. 8 million people living in what is essentially a failed state trying to build. And the descriptions of violence, the UN description of what's been going on, this rape and massacre, this division, ethnic division, based on the former vice president who now feels hard done by and wants, is being accused by the president of South Sudan of orchestrating coups. They went into this little oil town on the border of Sudan and South Sudan over the last couple of days, and the reports are they massacred a couple hundred people and wounded badly a few hundred more. I mean, this is a town of 7,000 people. I mean, they just went. This is epic in that little area, and it is such a tragic foreshadowing of the future of this broken country.
And the problem, of course, is that it's the center of oil for that country. They're not just fighting over cattle and grazing grounds; they're fighting over a huge amount in the future, money, and that will. And with money comes patronage. With patronage comes power, and there we're off.
And when we talked in the introduction to this bit about the hate speech, the sexual violence, the ethnic cleansing, if you will, the ethnic reality of the massacre, this is the sort of thing that stops it, that makes it harder and harder to reconcile oneself for two sides to reconcile themselves, presumably, because it is not, as you say, it's not geographical. It's not geographical. It becomes deeply and horrendously personal when it becomes that sort of violence, right?
I mean, one problem there, of course, is that before the government broke up, you had people, you had ministers from both communities. There was a certain collection, as it were. What you've got now, in the worst possible sense, is tribal warfare. And because you can identify one tribe from another, it's obvious who the so-called enemy is. This is not to say that there are not still Nuers in Dinka confidence and vice versa, but what I'm saying is that one or two or three or four men are going to be very difficult against hundreds, if not thousands, ferociously armed, vengeance-seeking young men.
When you read these reports, you have every reason to be incredibly pessimistic about the short-term and intermediate-term future for South Sudan. You know, it's the 193rd nation in the, to join the UN, and you know, it did it with all of this celebration in 2011. And you know, it's been it has been a hobbled start from the beginning, but now it's hard to see it getting anything but much worse. And this is really disturbing. I mean, this is on the scale of Rwanda, on a not in numbers, but in just terms of brutality. And it does suggest that we could see big numbers. I mean, it's not as big in population, but there's going to have to be fast action to try to contain this. But I'm not even sure that would help.
Yeah, one problem, of course, is Uganda's involved behind one of the, and so therefore it's not just a domestic, it now has external fighters involved, and this makes it much more difficult.
These broken countries, and there are only a handful of them on the planet, and it's the lesson that we see now is that we watch helplessly. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about our time is that we can no longer claim we don't know. You know, we can read about it on our iPhones and on our desktops, and we can see it, and yet we look helplessly and say, this is terrible. What do I do? What can we do? And it's in a sense, it's almost worth knowing, because you certainly simply as a viewer, as a consumer of news, you really have so few options. I mean, giving money to the Red Cross is not going to solve the problem in South Sudan.
And I'm just finally on this. Who are the personalities on each side? Who are we interested in the West? Who are the United Nations talking to? Who are they dealing with? Do we know? I mean, it's so tribal and it's so split down the middle like this.
Well, I suppose
you've got to make sure, I guess, you're befriending the right, inverted commas, people.
Well, that's the problem, is that outsiders hardly really know who the right is. It's the least worse option, isn't it? I presume that one would support President Kiir because he is the president. And the ex-vice president, Riek Machar, who's head of the others, started the rebellion on the 15th of December. So I suppose, since there's no winners here, you might as well go for the legitimate bad person.
You are listening to the voices of Geoffrey Kaufman and Kathy Burke. I'm Robert Bound. This is Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here at the aforementioned Midori House in London. We're going to take a short break and finish our news roundup.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Geoffrey Kaufman from ABC News America and Kathy Burke from University College London. Let's turn our attention now to the continuing crisis in Ukraine. Earlier today, US Vice President Joe Biden was in Kiev in a show of support for the new government. Let's listen to a bit of what Biden had to say.
Today, there are some who are trying to pull Ukraine apart. Ukraine is in a struggle for its very future.
And this also comes a day after photos emerged to allegedly show Russian special forces operating in eastern Ukraine. What's Biden's style compared maybe to John Kerry's style in this? I wonder whether who needs to be airlifted in first to speak to try and smooth Ukraine out.
Well, Biden is clearly the more senior political officer in this. Yeah. I mean, as vice president, and so you know, it's a show of support to a beleaguered and struggling government in Kiev, and you know, he it's pretty. That little soundbite you played didn't really say very much, I have to say.
It was a bit of a group hug there, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was waiting for some words that had a little more depth.
We'll just have to come up with them ourselves.
Yeah,
that'll be all right. And essentially, it seems to be taking the form of financial aid. I mean, this looks like what it's like, but it's not that much money.
$50 million is not much, and you know they're giving about $12 million or so to support the elections, the new elections next month. That's for the U.S. is a tiny amount.
They're more or less vamping till ready, aren't they? The question, I mean, the U.S. still doesn't really know what it can do. It doesn't know what it can do successfully. It has some idea of what it would like to do. But Europe is a waste of time in this particular crisis. The U.S. will have to be by itself, along with Poland, perhaps, and Estonia. Mm. So in that sense, it has to be careful. The best thing it could do, and it's not going to happen right away, of course, is get more oil, get more gas to Ukraine. And that isn't really going to happen.
Well, you know, I think the U.S. can't solve every problem in the world, and I think we've talked about it before around this table, but there is a kind of reality check that comes into here. Ukraine is not strategically the most important country for the U.S., and it's obviously much more important for Europe, in fact, but Europe gets so much of its oil through those pipelines from Russia that Ronald Reagan warned in the 1980s that building those pipelines would give Russia the upper hand of the Soviet Union at the time, and he was right. Now you've got Germany and Italy so reliant on the oil that comes in those pipelines that they walk this line of, oh my gosh, you know, what can we do? What can we do? This is terrible in Ukraine, but don't turn off the oil. So it is true that the U.S. is if not alone, there aren't a lot of actors that can play in this. But ultimately, the U.S. needs to show support for Ukraine. But they're not going to bring in military might. Nobody. There's no appetite. Nobody would suggest that they start a war with Russia over this.
Actually, it was even earlier than Reagan. It was Jimmy Carter, in fact, who warned the Germans that they should not, you know, help finance a pipeline between Germany and the Soviet Union. What I come back to my major point as an international stroke diplomatic historian, which is that the United States, it's irresponsible to encourage Ukraine too much if the U.S. is not going to provide some sort of support commensurate with this. If Ukraine thinks that the U.S. actually will do something, it could do something that would be unfortunate in relationship to the East. So in that sense, I very much agree with Jeffrey. There's a limit to what the U.S. actually can do. I mean, where do you project your power from? Germany?
And do we see that? Is that what we see in this Ukrainian crisis, the furthest reach that the U.S. foreign power can almost have? We can see it sort of clinging to a cliff face with this.
There's an interesting game going on right now. In 1947, I think it was George Kennan who wrote the U.S. foreign policy towards Russia, the Soviet Union, the Cold War, which was essentially this kind of isolate them and contain them. And I think, what you're seeing out of the White House right now is a new form of containment of Putin. And it's the relationships with Russia and the U.S. are too complex to simply say, we're pulling up the drawbridge, go your way. I mean, after all, you've got American and Soviet astronauts and cosmonauts in the space station. You've got the U.S. effort in Afghanistan being supplied by through Soviet territory. I mean, it is simply too complex to say we are going to unravel. But you are going to see more and more efforts to by Obama to work around Putin. Mm-hmm. Just watch for the next nominee for the U.S. ambassador to Russia, Obama was reluctant to do this, but now it appears he's going to nominate the former ambassador to Ukraine and Georgia, which will really not be it will not make Putin happy. But in a way, that's Obama sticking, you know, poking Putin and saying, we're not really that concerned what you think.
It's, I guess it's a bit of a needling bit of foreign policy, that rather than anything that maybe makes a difference.
What can Russia really accomplish? I mean, Russia can accomplish a lot. They can take a lot of Ukraine, but you know, ultimately, you know, they're lashing out because they don't like what's happened to the former Soviet Union and the expansion of NATO. But you know, there is a limit, and I think, you know, we've said it before, but you know, the question is, you know, Putin can win now, but will he win in history?
That sounds like a pithy epigrammatical ending. I think we're going to also have to leave it there, Kathy. I'm sorry, you were champing at the bit there, but we are out of time. I'd like to thank you both, Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News America and Kathy Burke from University College London. Thank you very much for joining us for this first hour at Midori House. We're going to have a teeny break and we'll come back with the news.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London,
desde Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty more to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll discuss a corruption scandal in Argentina, discuss why certain types of action movies are succeeding at the box office, and we'll also wrap up the week in music. But before we get started on that, it's news time once again at the bottom of the hour with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. The UN says hundreds of civilians have been killed in an ethnic massacre in South Sudan, which happened earlier this month. UN human rights investigators have confirmed that opposition forces killed hundreds of South Sudanese and also foreign civilians after determining their ethnicity or nationality when they captured Bentiu last week. The husband of an American tourist in a critical condition after being wounded by homemade improvised fireworks on the island of Santorini has asked that people pray for his wife. The US Vice President Joe Biden has visited the famous Mikhailovsky Monastery in Kiev after holding meetings with Ukrainian leaders today. He called on Moscow to remove troops built up on the borders of Ukraine and to, as he put it, stop talking and start acting on the surrender of pro-Russian separatist militants in the east of the country. And here, David Cameron's former media chief, Andy Coulson, has told a London court today he hadn't listened to hacked voicemail messages that exposed an affair between actress Sienna Miller and the James Bond star, Daniel Craig. And that, for the moment, is the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And Jonathan will be back at the top of the hour with another roundup of your world headlines. But in the meantime, you're tuned into Midori House, coming to you live here from Studio One on Monocle 24. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we're heading to the shores of Argentina. A little earlier on, I spoke to our man in Buenos Aires, Ed Stocker. What's happening in Buenos Aires? You've given us a list of stories, and there's a bit of a temporary structure making some headlines at the moment, right?
Indeed. I want to start with a tent, Rob. Essentially, they've constructed a huge 60 square meter tent in the middle of Buenos Aires, essentially like building something in Trafalgar Square, if you like. A group of people from some of the more peripheral areas of the city, people from visas from shanty towns, who are basically protesting about what they see as a lack of works from the government of Mayor Mauricio Macri. They're protesting at the lack of viable constructions and the fact that they still feel very much disconnected from the city. So the giant tent is a protest, and several of the people among them are also on hunger strikes as part of that protest, which is now in its second day, Rob.
And is this a sort of symbolic structure, Ed, or are people actually camping out inside this big tent?
People are actually camping out, and as I say, several of them are on hunger strike. It's quite incredible, and one of the things about Argentina is that you can, in terms of social protest, pretty much do whatever you like. I can't imagine something similar happening in some cities in Europe or the United States, for example. Being able to construct such a massive tent right in the center of town next to the Obelisk, which is one of the most important, I guess, tourist attractions in the city.
And just finally on this tent story, Ed, are there do you get the feeling that there's a sort of groundswell of opinion on either side? People are intrigued by it, perhaps, but maybe it's one of those things that might lose its luster when it becomes what might be considered a bit of an eyesore in the city.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't really miss it at the moment. I think it's definitely making a bold statement, Rob. Interesting, I guess, to shed some light, I guess, on a side of the Argentinian capital and the country in general, which is, you know, the thousands of people that do live in shanty towns. I mean, this isn't a city like Caracas or Rio, when you're surrounded by hills where you can see the pool buildings clinging to the hillsides in your face. Being flat as a pancake means that, in a way, the shanty towns that are here are often quite hidden from the sight. If you move in certain neighborhoods, you don't really ever come across them. So I think it's shedding an important light on something that hasn't been dealt with and that needs to be dealt with, and it's something that is often invisible for many residents in this city.
I wanted to move on, Ed. Someone else, a person rather than anything made of canvas, with flaps, with guide ropes, that's also been making headlines, is Maria Julia Alzogari, who's a minister during Menem's presidency in the 1990s. What's she doing back in the headlines?
Indeed. This is a political corruption case. Never seems to be that far from day-to-day life in Argentina. It's incredible quite how many ex-ministers and even occasionally presidents tend to spend at least some time in the dock, many of them linked to corruption. And poor Maria Julia hasn't had the easiest of times. She's, as you were saying, a government minister during Carlos Menem's presidency in the 1990s, essentially a time when Argentina had its major flirt with neoliberalism and when many of the state assets were sold off, including YPF, the recently renationalized oil company. She was essentially charged for corruption, for administrative fraud. This was over the privatization of a major telecommunications company, the National Telecommunications Company, Entel, for basically pricing contracts at the double of what they were worth and causing the government to lose some $250 million. Not actually the first time she's been found guilty. She's already been found guilty of illicit enrichment back in 2004. She's been found guilty three times, cleared once. Still not in prison. She still managed to stay out of prison, basically pending all the appeals in the ongoing cases. The justice system is quite a slow beast here in Argentina. But if she fails in her appeals, she will finally see a prison cell at the age of 71 years.
I suppose that's something that might still continue to run and run, Ed. We'll watch that space on Maria Julia Alzogari. And just to finish off, I wanted to ask you about a story that I think you've done for the magazine, for Monocle magazine, about Jorge Lanata, who's been a bit of a thorn in the side of the Kirchner regime. Tell us a little bit about this character.
Indeed. I interviewed him for the National Icon section in the magazine. Not sure yet if it's running next issue or the one after that. Jorge Lanata is the most high-profile journalist in Argentina. Quite a character, a big burly figure with a beard. Used to maintain a 60-a-day smoking habit. Recently had 5 stents fitted to keep him going. He has to give up smoking, otherwise, literally. A lot of people seem to think that he's going to not last that much longer. He's had a series of medical problems, needs to have a kidney transplant. But beyond all those problems, he's also, as you were saying, a major thorn in the side of the government, staunchly anti-Kirchnerist, although he says he's anti-corruption. It's interesting because he's kind of come full circle. He used to work for Página 12, which is a kind of left-leaning, now staunchly pro-government newspaper. And a few years ago, he kind of crossed the divide and joined Grupo Clarín, which is the most staunchly anti-government media group. And he now fronts a TV program has a radio show during the week, and also writes for Clarín, the main newspaper, basically exposing corruption, often the corruption of the present government. The problem for the government being that he's also massively popular. You know, he has almost half of the audience share when it comes to his radio show, which is, you know, massive for a radio show. And also his Sunday night TV program regularly tops the ratings. So, you know, the fact is a lot of people are watching him, and the government has tried to stifle him in the past by organizing football matches that it funds to be shown at the same time in a bid to try and win the ratings wars. But it hasn't quite managed to do that so far. And with a new show that he's just launched a couple of weeks ago, he promises to keep being a thorn in the side of the government for some time yet.
And that was Ed Stocker, our man in Buenos Aires, speaking to me a little bit earlier on. Up next, we'll ask what it takes to make a successful film at the box office. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One at Midori House on Monocle 24.
The beret is not just a French cliché. It's a cherished piece of heritage at risk of extinction. Monocle Films pays a visit to the last berry maker in France and meets an Irishman trying to revive this quintessentially French piece of headwear.
L'Olaire has now earned the label of Living Heritage Company, Entreprise de Patrimoine Vivant, a reward from the French government to salute a firm's excellence in keeping alive a unique tradition. As the last manufacturer of a product so deeply ingrained in French DNA, L'Olaire and its berets are worth fighting for.
Vive le beret, premiering on Monocle.com.
...1841 here in London, 1341 in New York. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Robert Bounds. Now, there's been an avalanche of superhero films in the multiplexes all around the world for some time now, and some film critics were saying that the market was going to get saturated, but with the success of Captain America 2, which has been the number one film in the US for the last 3 weeks, it seems that superheroes will remain with their golden box office status. So why are we so fascinated by men in latex? Will we ever get tired of seeing them on our screens? Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, caught up with film critic and Monocle contributor Karen Krizanovich to find out more.
Karen, as you know, there's been an avalanche of superhero films, and they tend to do very well at the box office. You know, but there's been some talk among film critics that the market will become saturated somehow. But I mean, just look at Captain America 2, the huge success.
Well, there was a huge worry that we're just, oh, more people in leotards, more people with underpants on the outside of their clothes, more people that can stretch their arms or fly, you know, oh, you know, you're just thinking more masks. But actually, the quality of the films that have been released that have done so well at the box office is very, very high. Now, you might say, well, but it's still superheroes. But the reason we liked superheroes in the first place is because they are very archetypical, they tell an important story, and they also have moral lessons. So as long as the examples of this are good, we're in good stead.
So do you think superhero films will continue to be box office gold for some time then?
I think they're working through, Marvel, for example, are working through what works for superheroes and franchises, because they're now looked at creating, they don't call them characters, they don't call them you know, separate films, they call them universes. Now, Marvel has an endless supply of characters to bring to the cinema screen and to smaller devices, obviously, because this, we're not only talking about going to the cinema, although initially we are, we're talking about enjoying these also on mobile devices, at home, etc. So they're creating a universe of characters, of films. And as long as they do that carefully, I think we'll respect what they do and give them our money.
You were mentioning about the quality of superhero films, that they're being incredibly good. I mean, can you tell us which are the good ones and the bad ones recently, if you may say?
Well, recently, gosh. We can look at, for example, Captain America, The Winter Soldier. I thought, oh, you know, I'm not crazy about Captain America. He's a bit boring. You know, it's a bit cliched. And actually, when I went to see it, there were a couple quibbles I had with it. But really, it tied in a moral story. It tied in American malaise, how we used to think about America, what America's like now, how the world is, but also had a lot of fun. If you want to be political, there's a lot of fun in there too. And also there's a lot of action. If you sit and watch the credits of Captain America, the Winter Soldier, there's a huge number of people that work in the art department, and that's all special effects, design. So visually, it's a real knockout. So this film works very, very hard to entertain us on all levels, and it works.
Most of the intelligence community doesn't believe he exists. The ones that do call him the Winter Soldier. He's a ghost. You'll never find him.
I joined SHIELD to protect people.
Captain, to build a better world sometimes means tearing the old one down. And that makes enemies.
And I think it works internationally as well. It's not only the US. I mean, I think those films in new markets like China, Brazil, Russia, they do extremely well.
Huge. These are films that don't rely necessarily on dialogue. For example, Chris Evans was saying that, you know, he was standing around doing a role and or a scene for Captain America. And he said he had like two lines of dialogue and he was like standing there for hours. So these films are about visuals. They're about iconic representation. They're about problems that every country and every person really faces. And it's about friendship. It's about love. It's about insecurity. It's about opportunity. And I think that Captain America, outside of the big, I don't want to do any spoilers here, but outside of the big crashes and the big fights and everything else, there's a lot of real character development and interaction there.
And what is the thing with men in latex? I mean, I want to talk about, well, there's not enough female heroines, I have to say. I mean, you have Katniss in the Hunger Games, but I mean, that's just kind of an exception.
Well, you've got Scarlett Johansson here, who looks amazing, and even though in the poster her arms were lengthened and her waist was made smaller, she's still pretty amazing. And actually, I don't want to spoil it because there's some surprise cameos in Captain America, the Winter Soldier, if you haven't seen it, so I don't want to say too much. But there's actually an underpinning of quite strong female roles there. I don't think that they're trying to make a big statement because this film is about Captain America and it's about war and heroism and how we look at soldiers and how we look at defense, I suppose. So in a way, women played a peripheral role, although an important role, to that. So we will have more female superheroes in the pipeline, I'm sure.
Do you think, let's say, if they do a film about Wonder Woman, do you think we'll do well in the box office?
Who doesn't love Wonder Woman? Everybody loves Wonder Woman. As long as they get it right and they don't take away her charm, because she had a lot of charm. And Linda Carter is going to be really tough to beat.
And also, Karen, I mean, there's been a story. I mean, the U.S., I mean, Captain America is the 3 weeks in a row number one, which is quite impressive for a blockbuster, especially in this busy season. But then you have this the new film by Johnny Depp, which I haven't seen. I mean, the critics didn't like it and it was a huge flop. I think it only got like $11 million and it cost $100 million to make. But it was an original idea. So do you think that's why Hollywood doesn't invest that much in new films, that they just kind of keep doing like Spider-Man 340 or something?
That's going to be a great film, by the way. Spider-Man 340. Can hardly wait. That's a really terrific question. And I think that's a very legitimate question. The problem is that studios are not in the business of making movies. They're in the business of making money. They have to. And they're still finding a way to find new markets and try and give the cinema goers what they want. But this film should have, I mean, it has all the hallmarks of being right, transcendence. It had Johnny Depp, it had Walter Pfister, who was Christopher Nolan's DOP. It had an interesting script by a first-timer. Certainly had a lot of money pumped into it. But they're saying that basically it had a marketing issue and people just didn't respond to it. So I think it's an interesting failure, but I also think that it was important that Warner Brothers and their co-producers really, really tried. It's got Chinese money in this as well. So it's really important that they tried to do this. It's a failure that needed to happen.
And finally, Karen, I just want to know, what's your favorite superhero?
I like the Silver Surfer, but not on screen. I'm the sucker for Hugh Jackman, I'm afraid. It's a bit sad.
Wolverine.
Yeah, Wolverine.
Or just Hugh Jackman, basically.
Just, no, Wolverine, because, you know, he doesn't, as long as he doesn't say anything, looks great.
And that was Monocle's film critic Karen Krasanovic speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Up next, world music. Stay tuned.
That's a very short little, what they call a sting there. It didn't really give us time to breathe. It's Tuesday, which means it must be time for our weekly music review. And this week we're joined by a man who certainly knows his way around the world of music. Phil Stanton is the man behind World Music Network, which he started with his Colombian-born wife, Sandra Aleon Stanton, in 1994. And Phil, welcome.
Thank you very much.
24. Welcome to Midori House. We've got to fill our listeners in on the World Music Network. This is a force for good in discovering excellent new music from all over the place, the four corners of the world, right?
Well, that's certainly our goal.
Does it have corners? I don't know. You know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yes. It's a turn of phrase. So we've been doing this 25 years now. 25 years of Riverboat Records, which was our first artist label, introducing new musicians from all over the world. And then 5 years later, we began working with the Rough Guides and producing a series of guides to the music of everywhere in the world, of which we now produced, I think, nearly 350. So it's a huge range, possibly one of the biggest, I think.
And these have become properly iconic things. Every decent shelf has at least two or three of your Rough Guides, and presumably a Riverboat record as well. But take us back to the beginning. How did you get into it? Was it travelling? Because this is the stuff that you wouldn't have heard on the radio, that you still don't really, that it's tough stuff to discover.
Yes.
That's luckily not the name of one of the songs we're going to be playing.
It began, I worked in Kenya as a 19-year-old in a school. I was a teacher. I came back and studied, and then I went back to work in Sudan. And in those experiences, in Kenya, I lived next to a bar which was playing music, you know, live music a lot. And I was already interested in playing in bands before I came away. And I was just blown away by the quality of what they were playing, which was very sort of Zairean-influenced East African thing. And the Luo part of Kenya, and they have these little hi-hats going the whole time. And fantastic guitar playing, just great. And, you know, at that time in your life, you're so open to things anyway. And I always say that those experiences rendered me unemployable in the conventional sense. So I had to do something. And when I came back from Sudan, I just fell into discussions with someone who worked at Stern's, which was the African music shop on Warren Street or Whitfield Street in those days. And I ended up working for them for a little bit. And then I was 25 when I began the label. So. It happened very quickly.
It's an amazing story, and it is that thing. I like the fact that you deemed yourself unemployable, or this music rendered you unemployable. There's only so many jobs you can get away with constantly drumming on your desk.
Well, I guess.
And you've got one where you can do that. That's all right.
Well, 25 years later, here we are. So we're gonna
put our money where our mouth is. We're gonna play a track or an excerpt of one that you've brought in. I'm going to say it as I think it should be said, and then you can correct me, Phil. This is Mattia Sankaita Dikasu, Eyes Like Yours. That was written down for me. I didn't translate that just off the top of my head. This is by Christy Stanisopoulou. And that was Christy Stanisopoulou with Eyes Like Yours from the record Greek Adelia. which you could guess perhaps by her surname. She sounds a little bit like a Greek Sandy Denny or something. That's really nice.
Yeah, she's great. And it's with her partner, Stathis Kelaviatis.
I left him off.
No worries. And they're a wonderful duo. They've been playing together actually as long as we've been a label. Since 1989 they started playing together in a kind of punk band, in fact, a Greek punk band way back in the day. So they have that indie sensibility, which you can hear coming through in some of that. It's perhaps not so obvious in that little clip we heard. And it's called Greekadelia because it's got sort of somehow psychedelic references to Greek music, but it's still very grounded in traditional music from the islands.
And yeah, it's got a sense of kind of an updated tradition to it. It's got a bit of a sort of, it's got a bit of a toy shop quality to it. That as well, I kind of like that. It's a bit of a DIY aesthetic, I suppose, punky aesthetic on there.
Well, he uses live looping and things like that, which is quite an interesting. To see them live is really exciting. And they are, in fact, playing live as part of this celebration we're having for the anniversary on the 17th of May in Rich Mix.
Oh, yeah, so tell us about that, actually, while we're on that subject. This is presumably people can rock up and see some of these people. The Rich Mix in East London, Shoreditch, right?
That's right, yes. Yeah. Barbican Tubes, probably the closest, but that sort of area. We're sort of celebrating the 25 years of Riverboat, 20 years of the Rough Guides. We have three bands playing, Jotsna Srikanth, Christy and Stathis, and the Kra Collective from Ethiopia. And it's presented by Radio 3's Lopa Kathari with DJ Ritu. So it's a really nice evening just to kind of come see a whole load of music and meet us and do something like that. So,
there will be dancing in the aisles.
There will be dancing, definitely. Yes.
We're going to play the next track because we've only got 4 minutes left, which is a bit of a shame. This is Jam 10 Kai Tight, Wait 10 Months More, and this is Ross Sarasarathaya. Man. Love that. That is Ross Sarasarathaya, and that is Wait 10 Months More. Slightly better pronouncing it on the way out than on the way into that one.
Perfect.
What's that album from, Phil?
Well, this is a new Rough Guide. It's actually not out yet. It'll be out on the 26th of May. It's called Psychedelic Cambodia, and it explores a very interesting period in Cambodia's history in the 60s and 70s. Before Pol Pot, before all the genocide and disaster that befell that country. And there was a period when there was this huge influence from the US and you just heard these, well, you can hear it there. It's a very much the sort of straight psychedelic sound, but with these fantastic vocals over the top. And it's got other little Cambodian influences as well. And I first came across this scene when a couple of the revival bands started to emerge. Dengue Fever is the big one, and then Cambodian Space Project. And what amazed me, actually, when I heard the source, I realized these guys were just playing it straight. I mean, you thought this was kind of a new fusion coming out of LA, but it wasn't. It was just replaying music that had been lost,
an amazing scene, that thing. It's these guys are amazing players as well, right? And it is that interesting thing. I guess there's the same thing in South Korea, because the army bases in Seoul, for example, broadcast and people could hear it in the city of Seoul. And so everyone started picking up guitars rather than maybe their traditional instruments. I guess you know this far better than I do. But that's an interesting thing where the inspiration filters out from the strangest of sources sometimes.
Absolutely. And quite interesting, it also comes back in different ways too. So it's not a one-way street, which is always nice to remember. I mean, the influence comes more from the West, but it comes back in interesting ways too.
And we're going to squeeze in, Phil, our last track. This is going to be a little bit of Ambassal by Kra Collective. We didn't have time to get into Kra Collective's And Basel, but that is originally included on the album Ethiopia Super Kra from Riverboat Records. The man behind Riverboat Records is Phil Stanton. Thank you very much for joining us and talking us through the wonderful stuff, and remind people quickly of when they can go and see these things in person.
17th of May at the Rich Mix.
Perfect. Phil, thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on this Midori House. Stay tuned. We'll see you next time.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.